Hello everyone, and welcome to Shedcast 9A, Cardinal Thomas Wolsey, the Glorious Peacock. As I believe I have mentioned in the free podcast, one of the delightful things about Tudor England is the rich pageant of individuals about whom we can now write with a little more detail and confidence than before. And there can be few reigns where we have quite such a choice as Henry VIII. Actually, we need to thank Henry himself for that a bit. He tended to get bored easily and so periodically gave one set of ministers, wives and minions the chop and moved on to the next lot. So for the Shedcasts, I think we'll have a series of biographies. Thomas Wolsey, Thomas Cromwell, Anne Boleyn, Thomas More. Characters who have both fascinated and divided opinion. Might also go for some shorter hacks at some of the lesser known but still fascinating guys. John Fisher, Stephen Gardiner, Thomas Wyatt, Nicholas Carew. The world, as they say, is my lobster. And so let us start with Thomas Wolsey, on the rather dull, boring and pedestrian basis that he's the first chronologically in terms of Henry's ministers. Uninspired and neoliberal of me, I appreciate. I've divided this podcast into two, as I did for the nationality thing, on the basis that it's just easier to digest. But of course you can listen to them both at the same time if you like. The first podcast, we'll talk about how history has treated him, who he was, where he came from and all that. The second, we'll look at his achievements, his fall and death. Ah, plot spoiler. Now, I said that there's a lot of controversy and divided opinion about these folks, and that's true. But any divided opinion about Wolsey took some time to emerge, it has to be said. Because at his time, and for 200 years after his death, actually opinion was pretty much decided, cut and dried, done and dusted, baked in. And the verdict was not good, gentle listeners. Not good at all. In fact, positively bad. Wolsey was the man that everyone loved to hate, particularly his noble adversaries, who universally despised Wolsey for his lowly birth and success in direct contravention of the great chain of being, and his absolute success in keeping the aristocratically chinless wonders out of power for 15 years. But there were fortunately some at the time that looked at Wolsey with a less jaundiced eye. The Bishop of Lincoln, for example, praised the fact that Wolsey took action against the enclosure of land, the enclosures that Thomas More complained about when he wrote that sheep ate men. Here is the good Bish. "There was never thing done in England more for the common weal than to address these enormous decays of towns and making enclosures." I've often come across a phenomenon at work where you find these managers who are bad-mouthed across the company, except by the people in said manager's department. There's an element of this with Wolsey, it seems to me. So, here's a chap called Richard Morrison, a Yorkshireman who is a dedicated servant of the Cardinal. "Who was less beloved in the North than my Lord Cardinal before he was among them? Beloved, after he'd been there a while." We are also very lucky to have had the views of one of the Cardinal's gentlemen ushers, a poet and biographer called George Cavendish. Cavendish wrote an enormously popular biography of Wolsey, which is pretty balanced, and which is a darn good read to boot. Cavendish presented the Cardinal's life as an exemplification of the wheel of fortune. "Great wealth, joy, triumph and glory, until fortune, of whose favour no man is longer assured than she is disposed, began to work some things wrong with his prosperous estate, through which she would devise a mean to abate his high port." But along the way, he had plenty good to say about Wolsey's character, talents and achievements. "I never saw this realm in better order, quietness and obedience than it was at the time of his authority and rule, nor justice better ministered with indifferency." So from the beginning, there is a positive thread to Wolsey's reputation. However, let us now start with the blizzard, the cascade, the waterfall of negativity and criticism that occupied the first 200 years after Wolsey's fall. We might start with Thomas More, who presents an interesting summary with this judgment. "Vainglorious was he, very far beyond all measure. And that was great pity, for it did harm and made him abuse the many great gifts that God had given him." This is the classic, "I'm not angry, just disappointed" approach beloved of parents and teachers across the world. But there was a man just as skilled with words as More, but with a less balanced motivation. This was the vicious satirist and propagandist, John Skelton, You might remember the name. Skelton at one time had been tutor to Henry VIII, before Mountjoy decided that there were better men of the new learning to educate a king. Skelton's comments on Wolsey are to be treated with great care. John Skelton was a pen for hire. At one stage he tried to hire himself out to Wolsey himself, and wrote some lines in favour of the lad. So you can't really take the lines as a detailed academic critique of Wolsey and his work, but you can take them as representing a popular view of the good cardinal, and they are sadly just too catchy to be ignored. It was John Skelton who appealed to the worst of medieval instincts by describing him as a butcher's cur. He built a picture of a vainglorious, dominating man, who set himself up as an alternative king. For example, in his complete control of the Court of Star Chamber. "All that matters there he mars, clapping his rod on the board, no man dare speak a word." Skelton reflected the views of factions at court who brought Wolsey low. The supporters of Catherine of Aragon, who wanted him gone for his attempt to replace her with Anne Boleyn. And the Boleyn faction, who wanted him gone so they could replace his control of the council with their own. After the cardinal had gone, the immediate generation following were no more positive. For men like William Tyndale, and later supporters of the Protestant cause in exile, he was the epitome of the ills and failings of the Catholic Church. Enormously rich, a bloated figure, gorging himself on the carcass of the material and political world, when he should have been reforming the church instead. The wily wolf, obsequious and serviceable, was how Tyndale described him in 1530. Edward Hall, meanwhile, really stuck the boot in. His chronicle of 1547 has Wolsey as the great deceiver. "Double both in speech and meaning. He would promise much and perform little. He was vicious of body, and gave the clergy evil example. He hated sore the city of London, and feared it." For Hall, and for following generations of Catholic writers, Wolsey was to be condemned for his attempt to win the king his divorce. So, now you can see the problem. Poor old Wolsey didn't have a natural constituency. In the words of Caesar, "Infamy! Infamy! They've all got it in for me!" Well, the words of Carry On Cleo. I apologise for quoting from a Carry On movie, and if you'll give me a minute, I'll go and beat myself with a hazel wand in penance. The Catholics hated him for helping the king get his divorce. The Protestants hated him for being a bloated symbol of all that was wrong with the old religion. Virgil and John Fox carried on the tradition, so did Holinshed, and in the 17th and 18th centuries, so it carried on, including through the pen of Samuel Johnson. A spot of balance began to creep in during the 18th century, when a strand appears at least recognising that Wolsey was a statesman, who managed to dominate politics for 15 years, and that surely we should at least try to recognise this was an achievement. Richard Fiddes, in 1524, wrote of the cardinal's natural dignity of manners and his intention to found a society of canon and civil law. And so we come, kicking and screaming, into the 19th century, where two instincts struggle with each other. On the one hand, Britain was becoming a world power and empire, and historians were keen to emphasise the talents of great men. And whether you like it or not, Wolsey was a great man. On the other hand, Britain was still fiercely Protestant, and Wolsey was a Catholic cardinal. So, in 1812, we have John Galt writing, "Haughty, ambitious, masterly and magnificent, he felt himself formed for superiority, and his conduct, if not always judicious, was uniformly great." But we have J.A. Froude writing, "A man who loved England well, but who loved Rome better." As the nationalist urge came stronger, Wolsey was increasingly seen as one of England's great statesmen. And so on to the 20th century, where A.F. Pollard's biography dominated the debate. In Pollard's view, Wolsey was primarily a cynically efficient administrator and power politician whose foreign policy was directed by the papacy. This is an interesting perspective. One of the debates about Wolsey is whether he formulated structured policies in a way that would be recognisable to the modern world. It was even suggested that he recognised and pursued the concept of a balance of power, something we'll come back to. Pollard saw Wolsey as a born loser and a born fighter, a man who ended up as a cleric not because he had a vocation, but because it was the only available career path for the ambitious man, and Wolsey would hardly have been alone in that. G.R. Elton then minimised him, presenting him as essentially a medieval chancellor, and of course this was against the backdrop of the man who would follow him, Thomas Cromwell, and be, in Elton's mind, the great reformer who ushered in the modern age. Christopher Hay saw a corrupt cardinal against whom, quote, no charge was too gross to be impossible. So that's a little mean, then. J.J. Scarisbrook was a bit more positive and revisionist, seeing, quote, something lofty and great about him. P.J. Gwynne in 1990 described a man with no higher objective than to carry on the government, pursuing policies formulated by Henry VIII. In this, we return to another theme of both Wolsey and Henry VIII's career. Who formulated policy, especially in the early years? Was it Henry, or was it his ministers? And finally, John Guy, writing from the place where all the greatest historians study, presents a balanced view of a statesman, again, essentially medieval in character, in the sense that to talk of a foreign policy or domestic policy was an anachronism. He paints a picture of a hard-working statesman, driven by a master in Henry, whose expectations were just unrealistic. It's a picture that historian John Matusiak also emphasises. Both are of a pragmatic, effective man, ultimately brought down because nobody can defy gravity forever. Have I unwarily slipped into a musical there? So there we are, folks, the battle lines are drawn. Contemporaries saw an arrogant, power-hungry beast, who thankfully finally received the rough end of the pineapple, having gorged for too many years on its flesh. Modern commentators have moved towards a much more secular and pragmatic picture of a politician doing his best. Is it just me, or does history still reflect society? With that thought hanging, let me take you to the town of Ipswich, on the extremities of East Anglia, not yet home to the tractor boys, since in 1475 tractors had not, of course, been invented. I am conscious that Thomas Wolsey would appear frequently in the Free History of England as part of the daily weft and warp of political life, so what we'll do in this shedcast is this. We'll start off with Wolsey's route to power. How do you climb the greasy poles in the days medieval? And then rather than chronologically moving through Wolsey and his life, let us look thematically at Wolsey's achievements and otherwise, his impact on domestic and foreign politics, and then his fall from power. I hope that sounds good. If not, I shall welcome comments. Medieval society was famously structured and hierarchical. Bucking the system was not just irritating, it was contrary to God's scheme of things. We might worry and bite our fingernails about the lack of social mobility in today's England. The darker, less generous part of our nature might look enviously at the person in a fast card who made a small fortune in the city or something. But hopefully, we'll grind out between gritted teeth, they've done very well for themselves, haven't they? But as the Butcher's Cur quote illustrates, you didn't need an excuse to point out that someone had a low social status in medieval England. Nobody was going to tut you and slay you with the sword of equality. Wolsey's background would dog him all his life and colour all of the contemporary assessments made of him. No aristocrat would ever find it easy to dance to his tune, and when the time of vulnerability came, they would tear him with their claws and rip out his throat with their jaws with joy and delight. I would also like to bet that it also coloured Wolsey's view of things. Is it a wonder that he revelled in his power and wealth? Would it really be surprising if he enjoyed watching the privileged Duke of Norfolk suck it up? He would not only be a more competent man than I, he'd also be a far better one. Famously then, little Tom is supposed to have been born above a butcher's shop in Ipswich, probably in 1471. The house cost £8. This is by no means a hovel, it's a comfortable house. But it's nice to confirm that this indeed speaks of a family who really ought to have known their place. And it's that of a reasonably comfortable trading family, not a hobnobber with the rulers of Europe. Now I suppose you either embrace that, or you try to avoid it. You either take the approach with people, I had nothing when I were a lad, we had to lick raw clean with tongue. Or you bury it under a blaze of materialism and propaganda, and hope people forget it. Wolsey, by and large, chose the latter. The Wolsey family escape from backwater to head honcho is a bit of a classic, actually. The success of the child from the ambition of the father. The Wolseys had been butchers throughout the 15th century, with some of the family going for innkeeper in smaller towns of Suffolk. But Robert Wolsey had bigger ideas. He moved to the teeming cosmopolis that was, and indeed is, Ipswich. He married into a well-connected East Anglian family in the form of Joan Daundy, and Joan and Robert did well enough to send their son to school, though it's possible that actually it was the Daundy family that stomped up the necessary. Either way, their son did them proud. Though both of them were dead by the time Thomas really hit the big time, Joan died last in 1509. Wolsey clearly had a brain Marvin would have been proud of, the size of a large orbital satellite, because he was picked out and sent to Magdalen College, Oxford, a college then just some 20 years old. There he probably had access to the greatest English exponents of the new learning, William Grocyn, Thomas Lineker, John Collett. And Wolsey did well. By the time he was just 15, in 1486, he'd graduated with a degree. It earned him a more complimentary nickname than the butcher's cur. They called him the Boy Bachelor. There is then a period when we really don't know what Wolsey was doing, with only snippets of information to his late 20s, early 30s, when in 1500 he won his first living, the parish of Lymington, given to him by the Marquis of Dorset. There are a few things. He's clearly been teaching since Dorset gave him the living on the strength of having taught his son. He appears on a list of fellows at Oxford and as a bursar of Magdalen. It looks as though he's living an academic life, has been ordained a priest, but has not yet committed to an academic career since he doesn't appear to have gone for a doctorate. Even at this early stage, there is a whiff of controversy hanging around him. One story has him being forced to resign from Oxford for the misuse of funds. Another has him being slung into the stocks in Lymington by a local lord he'd irritated. There are no details, but at very least he'd not found his path, and actually Wolsey's career was not meteoric until his mid-30s. In days medieval, of course, you needed a powerful friend to get where Wolsey at least wanted to go. And he found that friend initially in Henry Dean, the Archbishop of Canterbury, or at least he managed to get a position in his household. But the big one, the critical change in circumstance, was with Bishop Richard Fox, Bishop of Winchester and the leading counsellor of Henry VII. By 1507, Wolsey was a royal chaplain, was in the eye of the king as well as Fox, and successfully carried out missions on their behalf. Wolsey was now clearly beginning to have a ball, learning the ways of the court, impressing his patrons, gathering livings and becoming richer in his mid-30s. Sometime around here he also acquired himself a mistress, Joan Lark, and with Joan he had two children. Now despite the excesses of Rome and the Borgias and all that sort of stuff, actually clerical marriage and publicly having a mistress was pretty rare in England. No doubt it happened, but we've got to the stage where it's very clearly seen as an abuse of a churchman's vows and responsibilities. We are in sharp intake of breath and disapproving look territory. Was made worse by the two children, who, delightfully in line with the approved stereotype, were passed off by Wolsey as nephew and niece. As in, could you find my nephew a job? Wolsey would become seen by both Protestant and Catholic alike as a venal prince of the church, abusing the system to feather his own nest. Wolsey gave them plenty of ammunition. Seriously, he wasn't a career churchman with a vocation. Seriously, he was not an ascetic. He loved the power, wealth, display, politics, all of it. As we said earlier, one of the debates about Wolsey is about where you put him on a scale that starts at one end as an unscrupulous opportunist and on the other as an all-seeing strategist whose failures are caused only when Henry stuck his nose in and messed everything up with his unreasonable expectations. In a way, the debate is a bit irrelevant. One Victorian historian compared Wolsey to a prime minister, which rather illustrates the problem or the difference. Such a comparison like that is anachronistic. A prime minister is a constitutional position with rules. Wolsey was in the end just the king's favourite fixer. And in the final stage of Wolsey's rise to power, I think you can see this. Wolsey knew that there was one basis for power, and really only one. Something so important that everything else was a small, almost invisible pimple by comparison. This was the king's grace, the king's favour. The king could make of you what he wanted to, especially a strong king. Although we'll talk constantly of faction, faction only existed to influence the king, not to form parties and to rule. The king was the start, middle and end of everything. So up to 1511, Wolsey was Richard Fox's man. On the death of the old king, Fox managed to push him forward and get him appointed as the king's almoner, and promoted him in opposition to the Noble War faction, and so Wolsey wrote passionately to his mentor Fox about the ins and outs of the Peace Party and the War Party, sharing Fox's desire for peace and the continuation of Henry VII's cautious and careful policies. But in 1511, Wolsey saw the way the wind was blowing, that this young king would declare war at some point, come what may, that the medieval lust for war against France was in his very blood. And so, Wolsey did a complete volte-face. You can call this unprincipled, but really it isn't. Wolsey saw his job as carrying out the king's will. That's the way it worked. Henry was at the head of the chain of being. Wolsey might intellectually agree with Erasmus, More, Fox and the humanists and their passionate arguments against war, but if the boss said war, war he should have. This is exactly how his contemporary George Cavendish pitched it. All his endeavour was only to satisfy the king's mind, knowing right well that it was the very vain and right course to bring him to high promotion. Wolsey also eyed up the boss and figured out how this young man worked. Henry was out for a good time hunting, shooting, fishing, at the very best a big picture man, don't bother me with the detail. Famously, Henry even said that he hated writing and found it really hard. Wolsey, on the other hand, was a workaholic. He would take the burden of government away from Henry's shoulders. George Cavendish again. Putting the king in comfort that he shall not need to spare any time of his pleasure for any business that should necessarily happen in the council, as long as he being there. There's more than this, though. Put simply, Henry liked Wolsey. As close as could be between king and his minister, Wolsey and Henry were friends. They walked together arm in arm in a way that Henry and Thomas Cromwell, for example, never would. They worked well together, so closely that you might say they arrived at policy together, though in the end we should never doubt it was Henry's decision that counted. At the end, Henry would cut Wolsey off at the knees, but actually he dithered and gave Wolsey more leeway than he did for any of his other servants. Wolsey was a man of wide talents. Even his detractors were forced to acknowledge his wit, intelligence, his easy and companionable manner when he wanted to. Henry liked working with Wolsey. Many times, Wolsey would rely on and use that bond. And Wolsey was good. Although Wolsey was on the King's Council from 1511, the big change came in 1513 in the war in France. Wolsey organised every detail of the logistics of the campaign. He worked tirelessly. Cavendish relates how he worked from 4 a.m, not even getting up to eat or indeed see a man about a dog. The logistics of the campaign were perfect. And from then on, Henry knew this was the man who could help deliver what he wanted and allow him the freedom to holy while he did it. And say what you like about Henry, he does pick talented men to run his ministries, big men. Henry liked and looked for flair and ambition. He did not let the accident of birth get in the way of making the right choice for men like Wolsey and Cromwell. Once in place, Wolsey knew how to pitch ideas to Henry and to work with him. There's a lovely description by Cavendish about how Wolsey would come to Henry with a series of difficult decisions. Every time he wished to obtain something from Henry, he introduced the matter casually into his conversations. Then he brought out some small present or other, a beautifully fashioned dish, for example, or a jewel, or a ring of gifts of that sort. And while the king was admiring the gift intently, Wolsey would adroitly bring forward the project on which his mind was fixed. This again seems cynical, but Wolsey never forgot where the basis of his power lay again. His noble opponents were to misunderstand this. What they saw was a monopoly of power and themselves excluded from it. And to an extent that's true. But actually Wolsey always scrupulously observed the correct forms. He worked with the King's Council. Every decision went through the Council. But before he went to Council, Wolsey had talked the issue through with the King. So for the Council, they were then faced with a choice. To argue with Wolsey was effectively to argue with the King. And the king didn't like being argued with. Wolsey was therefore an enormously effective manager and administrator. He was also an extremely able politician. You don't dominate a Tudor court for 15 years without being a superb politician. Wolsey's dominance didn't go without challenge. As we've said, his strategy was to be the man who could take all the cares of the world away from the king, take all the work onto his shoulders, so that Henry could concentrate on partying, hunting, shooting, fishing. But this gave him a problem. The more time Henry spent playing, the more time he spent with his minions, the young noblemen around Henry at the royal court. And from here came the challenge to Wolsey's dominance. These were Henry's natural companions, the scions of the great houses and peers of England. And why did the great families gather round the king? Because by the time of Henry's England, the court was the source of all patronage and power. David Starkey quotes G.R. Elton rather nicely, I think, to emphasise a point we've heard many times in the history of England. It was the man who could help his servants and friends to the advancement under the crown who mattered in the 350 years between the first Tudor and the Hanoverians. So in 1517, Wolsey suffered a reverse when one of the minions, William Coffin, used his contacts to arrange a marriage with an heiress, who Wolsey had promised elsewhere. It gave Wolsey an early, sharp reminder that however distant Henry appeared to be, however cheerfully he gave up business to be handled by Wolsey, he must never let any distance grow between him and the king. He must stick to him like the proverbial rash. Probably not quite as close as the groom of the stall, but we're talking limpets here. The Venetian observer Giustiniani recognised that the minions worried Wolsey, that he perceived them to be so intimate with the king that in the course of time they might have ousted him from the government. Wolsey had made sure he had a man next to the king in a bloke called Richard Pace, the king's secretary. Day and night, Wolsey would now know what the king was doing, and he owned the gatekeeper to the king in Richard Pace. In May 1519, the minions were all expelled from court. Quite simply, Wolsey had them denounced before the council for being, quote, youths of evil counsel and intent on their own benefit to the detriment, hurt and discredit of the king. That Wolsey was able to convince Henry of this case is itself as strong an evidence as you could wish for of the bond and trust that Wolsey had built with the king. Though it's also pretty clear the minions' behaviour didn't help them out. To follow this up, the heavens opened and a storm of new administrative proposals fell from the sky from Wolsey's fertile pen. Suddenly, the king had no time to worry about whether he was happy that his minions had been pushed unceremoniously from the king's council to be replaced by Wolsey's men. Now, the minions will be back, and keep coming back as it happens. After all, Henry was himself the patron of noble reaction to the bureaucracy of his father. But Wolsey was equal to the challenge, feeding Henry's anxieties and paranoia about the noble faction next time round. Here's a fascinating note that Henry himself wrote to Wolsey, after Wolsey had been doing a bit of work on him. Make a good watch on the Duke of Suffolk, on the Duke of Buckingham, on my Lord of Northumberland, on my Lord of Derby, on my Lord of Wiltshire, and on other which you think suspect. There was, of course, another strand in Wolsey's usefulness to the king and his control of political power, his status as a cardinal. In 1514, Wolsey was made the Archbishop of York. In September 1515, he was made a cardinal and a legatus a latare, literally from the side of the Pope, papal powers. He gave him enormous powers over the English church above and beyond those of the Archbishop of Canterbury. Enough said. Essentially, while Wolsey stayed on top of government business, and while Wolsey held the trust and friendship of the young king, he was equal to any challenge that could be brought against him. His fall would only come when both deserted him at the same time, when in Anne Boleyn there was a challenger to the king's friendship, and in the failure of the king's great matter, there was a failure in Wolsey's control of government business. But that's all in the future. There's no need to be all gloomy. Now is the time to celebrate and live it up in Wolsey's heyday, in all his glory. With his grip on power vice-like, Wolsey filled up his boots. He is accused of being a venal and utterly corrupt prince of the church, flouting any sense of pious asceticism and propriety. Actually, it's possible to defend Wolsey from the corruption charge. It really is a complete waste of time to try and defend him from being a pretty perfect example of the worst aspects of the medieval church in the sense of pluralism and earthly wealth. Thomas Wolsey was as pious as the next medieval man. He heard Mass a couple of times a day, but he was no more than that. He joined the church for a career, not a vocation. He had multiple church positions, which earned him an absolutely stonking income of 9,500 quid a year. Now look, this is just extraordinary. He was easily the richest man in the country after Henry. He was richer than even Warwick the Kingmaker had been. Warwick the Kingmaker had been a two-bit loser compared to Wolsey. Think about it. He had income of about 10% of the entire normal revenues of the crown. Now, I think the UK annual tax income is about 600 billion. So, imagine having an income of 10% of that, 60 billion. I realise this is a terrible comparison, but nonetheless, bet you wouldn't lie awake worrying about the monthly groceries bill. Wolsey threw himself into the fun of all of this. He flaunted his wealth. He indulged himself as a great patron of the arts. I confess I've always had a problem with this one. In the analysis of the achievements of the rich and famous, throwing their patronage to the arts is always seen as a great thing. Oh, he was a great patron of the arts. Well, look, to be honest, and with a smidgen of curmudgeon, it's just a hobby, isn't it? If I was taking 60 billion from the public purse, let me tell you, I would also be a great patron of the arts. The same compliment often gets made of Charles I. It's difficult to take that seriously, isn't it? But in terms of understanding why Wolsey's managed to put a few backs up, it's well worth a bit of coverage. So, let's start with the Palace of Whitehall. All the bishops and archbishops had their London pied-à-terre. Well, whopping great big London palace is probably a better name. I wouldn't want to give an impression of the Bijou or the Bohemian. The Archbishop of York was no different. And so Wolsey had a London residence as Archbishop of York, very close to the Royal Palace of Westminster, and at this point called York Place. Wolsey chucked money into its expansion, with a new chapel, water stairs onto the Thames, a 200-foot gallery, gardens and orchards, and a magnificent great chamber where Wolsey received his visitors in all his glory and staged his lavish entertainment. So lavish that pretty much every foreign visitor of the time remarks on the fact that the English ate way too much. Slightly embarrassingly, York Place was actually a good deal more magnificent than the King's own residence. Westminster Palace had been partially damaged by fire in 1512. York Place was far more sumptuous and up-to-date than the King's own London Palace, which was, frankly, a little awkward. And yet it wasn't enough. Such was the extent of Wolsey's household and the extent of the business he conducted on behalf of the Crown that he complained to the King that really York Place was terribly cramped and he needed something much more suitable. And so, down the River Thames was born Hampton Court Palace, a few hours boat ride from Westminster. It was built on a truly grand scale and even to the hardened Italian courtier it was extraordinarily sumptuous. 280 rooms for guests, long galleries, furniture covered in silk, all the windows expensively covered in glass rather than shutters, with the best craftsmen flown in from Italy and Flanders and the houses of Europe scoured for their very best works of art. Hampton Court set the fashion for every great house in England for the next century. If you are getting the impression that Wolsey wasn't shy and retiring or diffident, then you are reaching entirely the correct conclusion. Wolsey duly filled these grand palaces with an enormous household of over 400 staff. His household actually rivaled the King's in size. Wolsey had no intention of living like a monk in the middle of all this magnificence. You'll know from his portrait, if you've seen it, that the lad was carrying a few more pounds than he probably ought to be. Actually, he'd gone to the trouble to get a special church dispensation from fasting. And despite the enormous size of his household and kitchens, he made sure that Hampton Court had his own very special, smaller, personal kitchen and staff. This is a delightful innovation. If the shedcasts really take off, I may do the same and employ a chef for my very own donut kitchen. So you can be sure your subscription has been put to good use. There's a very long quote which gets used constantly, which paints a picture of Wolsey in all his magnificence, the glorious peacock as he was described. It's far longer than I'd normally do, but it paints such a fantastic picture that I'm going to quote it in full. It's from George Cavendish again, describing how Wolsey came forward from his private apartments in the morning. So, here we go, quote. Sorry, it's very long. Apparelled all in red, in the habit of a cardinal, which was either 25 of fine scarlet, or else of crimson satin, taffety, damask, or kaffir, the best that he could get for money. and upon his head a round pillion with a neck of black velvet set to the same in the inner side. He had also a tippet of fine sables around his neck, holding in his hand a very fair orange, whereof the meat or substance within was taken out and filled up again with the part of a sponge, wherein was vinegar, and other confections against the pestilent airs. To the which he most commonly smelt unto, passing among the press, or when he was pestered with many suitors. There was also borne before him first the great seal of England, and then his cardinal's hat, by a nobleman or some worthy gentleman, right solemnly bareheaded. And as soon as he was entered into his chamber of presence, where was attending his coming to wait upon him to Westminster Hall, as well noblemen and other worthy gentlemen, as noblemen and gentlemen of his own family. Thus passing forth with two great crosses of silver borne before him, with also two great pillars of silver, and his pursuant at arms with a great mace of silver gilt. Then his gentlemen ushers cried and said, "O my lords and masters, make way for my lord's grace." Thus passed he down from his chambers through the hall, and when he came to the hall door, there was attendant for him his mule, trapped altogether in crimson velvet and gilt stirrups. When he was mounted with his cross-bearers and pillar-bearers, also upon great horses trapped with red scarlet, then marched he forward with his train and furniture in manner as I have declared, having about him 4 footmen with gilt poleaxes in their hands. And thus he went until he came to Westminster Hall door. This is just a wonderful image that Cavendish paints, or at least for me it really helps me visualise the Cardinal in all his glory. The same ritual of coming forth was very much part of Henry's life as well. This is a standard ritual of the Renaissance great man and prince. Though Henry tended to come forth simply to proceed to the chapel, rather than like Wolsey to business at Westminster Hall. But you can imagine the crush of petitioners eager to catch the great man's eye, desperate to get his help on some appointment or petition or legal issue. And then out he comes, dressed in the richest and most magnificent of clothes and jewels, surrounded by guards and servants clearing the way, a pomander pressed fastidiously to his nose, until off he went in procession to conduct the business of the day. Once a week his procession would be to Greenwich or maybe the Palace of Bridewell to see the king, when he'd use his gilded barges to travel down the river to the bridge, then land, go around the other side of the bridge to avoid the rapids caused by the piers of the bridge, and thence to Greenwich to see the king. This is a prince of the church in the grandest Renaissance tradition, a man of confidence, political skill, and a love of power. He has some right to his winning. He works from morning to night in the service of the state. He's a consummate politician. He loyally and competently fills the role his master demands of him. But you can, I think, imagine why the likes of the Dukes of Buckingham and Norfolk seethed with impotent fury as he lambasted them at a King's Council meeting, stripped them of all effective power, and utterly controlled the political agenda, to the point where there was no need for faction. Faction dies during Wolsey's reign, because all was in the hands of the Cardinal. The ultimate point was made again by the sharp satire of John Skelton, which, like all satire, was most effective when it reflected a real uncomfortable truth. That actually, if you were after an advancement or power, you didn't bother going to the king's court anymore, you went to Wolsey's. Why come ye not to court? To which court? To the king's court or to Hampton Court? So there we have a picture of Wolsey and how he came across, his evident enjoyment of power. In podcast B, we will continue the story to look at what he actually achieved, why he fell, and how he died.